Today's Keisho will be on Case 47 in the Book of Serenity, Zhaozhou's Cypress Tree. Introduction. The cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower telling of a boundless spring, like one drop revealing the water of the ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? Case. A monk asked Zhaozhou, "What is the living meaning of Chan Buddhism?" Zhaozhou said, "The cypress tree in the yard." Verse. The bank lined with snow, the river containing autumn, the ocean drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. But let me read it again, I didn't read it properly. The bank eyebrow lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace. Old Zhaozhou, stirring up the monasteries, never stopping even now, uselessly expending effort, still the card is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, still it fills the ravines and the gullies. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice. This morning when Jaru is staying at my house, and when we left the house this morning, you could feel that the spring is on the way. It's really exciting. Driving here, sun is coming up. Very beautiful. I want to thank all of you for coming today on this day when spring is just beginning. I know that some of you have come a fairly long distance. Some of you have driven all the way over here from Princeton, and some people have come all the way down from the city, from Brooklyn. I know that takes a lot of commitment. You know, probably at the end of a long week of work, you know, many people just think I'm going to sleep in on a Saturday and take it easy. The idea of ending the work week and then getting on a train and coming down to New Jersey, maybe staying over at somebody's house, maybe sleeping on the floor. You know, that all takes a great deal of commitment, and I'm really grateful to you for that. Some of us in this room have been practicing together for many, many years, like 14 years. I think that's a very deep kind of friendship. You know, all of us have been, some of us, I've been doing this for 14 years, and it's always, you know, entailed a little bit of a sacrifice. You know, I have to end of a long. Sometimes I've been so tired on a Friday night, and I've gone to bed and gotten up maybe at 5 to get here in time for opening up the building, And I've just been so tired. I've been sitting on the cushion. I can remember times when I've just been just trying, struggling not to fall asleep on the cushion. And you know, there's been more than one occasion like that in the last 14 years. It's been a lot. And I know other people are in that situation too. This morning when I was sitting, I opened my eyes to see how everybody was doing, and I saw a fair number of people sort of falling forward and catching themselves, you know, starting to go over and catching themselves, and it was happening all across the room, you know. So I'm sure many people were tired today and struggling with the sleepiness, but you still came here. And as I say, some of us have been doing this for a long, long time. And I think that's a very deep, deep friendship, really a deep friendship, deep relationship. Coming to practice, sitting together in the Buddha mind, just really quite profound. It always involves an act of commitment, I guess you could say. You have to get on the train and come down from Brooklyn, or get in your car maybe on a cold morning or a rainy morning and drive all the way over here. And then people sit together and multiply that by 20-some Saturdays every year by 14. That's a lot of sitting together. I was so happy last night because one of our newer members had a deep samadhi experience. This is a person who's been coming pretty much, I think, just... Actually, I think this person came maybe last year on one of the beginner's nights. And he gave it a try for a couple times, and then he went away, and I didn't see him for maybe a year. And then this semester, he turned up again here in the Zendo on beginner's night, and I vaguely recognized him. I asked him, you know, is this your first time? And he said, no, I came last year. And so he sat, and sometimes people... come here and they give it a try for a little while, and they go away, and they come back and they give it a try and they go away, and I never see them again, you know. But sometimes people, it doesn't make much sense when they first do this. But then they go away and they come back, and sometimes, it's rare, but sometimes people really get into it. So last night, this person, at the end of the evening, I went up to him and I said, how was your sit? And he had a big, like a Cheshire cat smile on his face, like big smile. I said, how was your sit? And he said, it was fantastic. I said, really? What happened? And he said, it was the strangest thing. I felt like my whole body had disappeared, and I was having an out-of-body experience, and I was just floating. And I said, well, that's samadhi, you know, congratulations. That felt great, didn't it? And he said, oh, it was just wonderful, so sweet. It's just this beautiful, sweet experience. So I hope he'll come back. And I told him the truth. I said, you know, you might not have another experience like that for another 10 sits, you know, maybe even longer. And I should have said, although I didn't, I should have warned him not to try to repeat the experience. He just needs to do exactly what he did, just sit on the cushion and watch his breath and have no expectations. If he tries to repeat that experience, it might never happen again. But hopefully he'll come back and I can give him that advice. But it was exciting all the same to see somebody have that kind of an experience. I guess I had smaller or less dramatic versions of that when I started sitting, and it was a tremendous relief, you know, tremendous relief. When you start practicing meditation, you learn to sit on the cushion and breathe with your hara, your dantian. Initially, it's like you have some immediate relief from stress. So you really pretty much just by focusing on the breath get a big release from stress. If you've been under a lot of pressure and you just sit for half an hour and you watch your breath, most people have an experience of deep relaxation. There's actually a relaxation response which is triggered by deep breathing and sitting still. And it's a wonderful experience in itself. It's very, very beautiful, and it's so good for you. Apparently, very good for your heart. Your cortisol level drops. Your heart rate drops. If you have problems with constriction, hypertension, this is very good for that. And so, at that stage, many people have a good experience, and then they go away for the night, and they probably come back, or some of them come back. And if they come back again, they might not have the same experience. I've mentioned this before. If you do meditation long enough, that relaxation response is going to continue, but a new problem is going to arise. And that is that you will notice that you start remembering things that bother you. So, you know, at first, just watching the breath is very new and interesting. And the whole Zen sort of ritual, if you want to call it that, it's not really a ritual, but the whole whole ritual aspect of this is interesting, sort of interesting. And so you're watching your breath and you get a relaxation response and you think this Zen is great. So then you come another night and you sit down and you're waiting to have the relaxation response, and indeed you will have it, but also what you begin to notice is whatever's under the surface of your consciousness. Mm-hmm. And this is the part that some people don't like. And in fact, after this, I think a fair number of people, if they're going to quit, they quit at this point. Because people imagine that Zen is all about coming in and sitting on the cushion and blissing out, having like deep relaxation, sort of like very pleasant experience, beautiful experience, and so on. And this is a problem for this attitude is a problem for a number of reasons. It's a problem for one thing because if you start meditating more, you're going to notice that the things that bother you are float to the surface. It's like at first the surface of the pond was so clear and still, and now it's beginning to be agitated again. And things that maybe bothered you during the day, you'll become more aware of, or even things that bothered you long ago, you'll become aware of. Actually, this is where meditation, you could say, really starts. This is where meditation really starts. The relaxation response is really just relaxation. You know, some people will tell me, I say, do you practice? And they'll say, yes. And I'll say, how much do you sit? And they'll say, I sit 15 minutes every day or 20 minutes every day. And that's good. I'm glad they're doing that. But actually, if you sit about 15 or 20 minutes, you're just going to have a relaxation response. Meditation really starts on the other side of that response. So when you're keyed up and you start watching your breath and you go down a few notches and you might find that you're calmer, and then these things start bubbling to the surface. That's really where meditation starts. And you have maybe memories of things that have happened during the day, like tapes replaying in your mind. And generally, those tapes are linked to emotional responses. So the tapes and the emotional responses are what we Zen people mean by karma. So karma doesn't really mean your fate. So if you go outside into the street as you're leaving here and a car almost hits you, or a car hits you, that wouldn't be your karma, that's just an accident. Accidents can happen to anybody, but karma is actually your mental habits in Buddhism, mental habits. So karma would be like if you go across the street and somebody almost hits you, and you go home and you can't get it out of your mind, you're shaking, and it bothers you when you try to go to sleep tonight. And every time you cross the street, you feel nervous. That would be karma, see? So it's like the traces that events leave on your mind, body, and heart. And actually, all events, or many events, leave traces. We're not consciously aware of them. But they're there. My mother's mother used to lock her in a little closet sometime, a pantry, if she was bad. I don't think that's cruel. My grandmother was actually a very kind person, and when my mother was like a really little girl, I guess my grandmother would just sometimes just lock my mother in the pantry and say, "Now you've been bad." It was like a time out, I guess. But my mother had a claustrophobia, you know. So closed-in spaces made her feel very frightened and fearful, and she'd begin to hyperventilate. And that might have been caused by, like, my grandmother locking her in the pantry, you know, somehow. So that would be like karma, you know. So there's big events and little events, karmically. Some things are trivial, but they have a big impact on us, you know. And some things are big, but they don't bother us so much. But at the end of the day, you sit down on the cushion, and sometimes you'll notice that the tapes are playing in your head, and you're getting these emotional responses. This is where meditation really starts. So many people think, "Oh, I couldn't meditate tonight because I had all this junk going on in my head." But actually, that's meditation. Relaxation is just the calmness. When you begin to have the tapes replaying in your head and you get these conditioned responses, these automatic responses that are karmic in nature, the way to deal with them is to come back to your breath or come back to mu, and little by little they stop haunting you. They stop triggering these responses. This is called working through. So this is really crucial. A lot of Zen practice, much of Zen practice, is working through these conditioned responses. Now, in Zen, we have something called koans. Some of you are rather new to all this. So we have something called koans. This is a koan that I'm talking about right now. Koans are like little stories that have a centerpiece in the story. There's like a central question or detail, and you meditate on that. And often what happens is that it helps you to become aware of something in your karma that you had concealed from yourself. When I was a kid, I spent some time in Baltimore, Maryland. And at that time, Baltimore was a very tough place. And even now, when I drive through Baltimore, I get a bad feeling. See, that's karma. I lived in an area on Lock Raven Boulevard. My father was working at a military base called Fort Holabird. And I went to a York Elementary School. And I had to walk from our apartment to the school. And it was a good day if I didn't get in a fight. It seemed like all the kids in this neighborhood wanted to beat me up, you know. And at that time, I wasn't as tall as I am now, but I was sort of average in height. And I wasn't big, you know, physically big. So I really was an easy target, I guess. And I would be afraid all the way to school and afraid all the way back. And I went, you know, a number of years like that, and you begin to develop a habit of fear. But nobody wants to think of himself as a frightened person, right? Like a frightened little rabbit, you know. We all want to, you know, we go to the movies and we see a hero leap from a helicopter to a skyscraper and knock down three people with a punch. And we identify, we want to be the hero, right? Nobody wants to be the person who's afraid over in the corner. But we want to tell a story about ourselves which goes, I am the hero, you know. But deep down inside ourselves, you know, maybe we're a frightened person, you know. And so we don't want to deal with that. We don't want to look at that aspect of ourselves, but it affects us all the time. You know, even if we want to tell a story about ourselves, I am the hero, inside of us there's a lot of fear that we don't want to look at because it doesn't fit our story, you know. So anyway, when you work with a koan, it helps to get through the stories and get into the karma, if that makes any sense. You know, we have a kind of image of ourselves which is usually quite false, you know, very false. And we don't want to look at what the situation really is, usually. When people get to be very, very, very unhappy because there's this big split between the image of themselves and the reality, or the image of their lives and the reality, they might try Zen or they might go to a psychotherapist, you know. And those are both good options. And they work well together. But generally speaking, we're able to sort of sustain the illusion that we cling to of ourselves and go on. But we're sort of like held back or we're really crippled in a way because we can't really deal with what's inside, you know. So koans help us to open up, to see what we don't want to see. Not just about ourselves, but about many things. So you might have a koan that says, show me your face before your parents were born. And if you sit with that, you begin to maybe have, maybe begin to remember things you totally forgot about, or you begin to have deal with emotions that you don't want to necessarily deal with. So koans are like open up. They're like, they perform the function of like opening us up into like a deeper part of ourselves. And allow us to see things more clearly as they really are. And if we can be more open, and if we can work through our fear and our illusions, basically, our illusions, we can have a more honest relationship with everything around us in the world, a more open and honest relationship. And that's quite beautiful, I think, quite wonderful. When people assume we're going to have a sesshin, a meditation retreat, and people will be arriving on Tuesday night for that sesshin. And it will end on Sunday night at around 6 o'clock. And Sesshin is quite special. It's not always possible to go because we have all kinds of work commitments and so on. But it's really quite a wonderful experience. On the last day of Sesshin, I think, people's faces actually look different. You know, that it really is the case that it's like that people look younger. A lot of the tension has gone out of people's faces. And often they're much more open and relaxed and at ease. And it's really quite beautiful to see. The first time this happened to me was many years ago. The first time I observed this was many years ago. One of my Dharma friends was a woman named Corinne Friedlander. And if you go online and you type in Corinne Friedlander, C-A-R-Y-N, and then Friedlander, F-R-I-E-D-L-A-N-D-E-R, sometimes some of her paintings are online. You can see them. And they're beautiful. She's a wonderful artist. I love her stuff. And she teaches at a college in Seattle. But her husband was a man named Richard. And Richard Eggemeyer was his name. And he had a business job, and he was under a lot of stress. And Corinne was going for her PhD in art history, and that she really wanted to be like an artist herself. And Richard was like always tense. Whenever I'd meet him, he was friendly. He's a nice guy, but his face was like a mask of tension and fear, really. And I remember we went to a sesshin, and Corinne finally got Richard to do some sitting, which is, he was, you know, quite reluctant because he's such a busy guy and so on. And he came to sit, and he stuck with it. And finally, she actually talked him into a sesshin. And I think he came with some reluctance, and he had a difficult time. I mean, he was physically uncomfortable. But at the end of the sesshin, his face was literally glowing, and he was like walking on air. It was so beautiful to see. And of course, I think one of the things that makes Dharma friendships so beautiful is that we go through this process together year after year after year. You know? I personally think it's the deepest kind of intimacy, you know, really. You know, all in the course of a sesshin, you know, a lot of your barriers go down, and you know, we're normally so interested in or so desperate to be a certain kind of person, whatever we imagine would be a good kind of person to be, and we're so desperate to be liked and loved. And we're so terrified of being rejected, right? I mean, these are elemental human... Humans are social beings, you know, we're social primates. Of course, for hundreds of thousands, millions of years, our survival has depended on the ability of other of others in our group to trust and support us, right? And so how others think of us is very, very, very deeply hardwired, I guess, you know? And we want to be a certain kind of person, and of course we're generally not the person we imagine ourselves to be. Actually, that's just the case. In fact, on a very deep level, nobody is actually the person he or she imagines himself to be. And so, you know, a lot of us have a kind of desperation about this matter of being acceptable to others. And it takes tremendous work. It's a very big strain all day to be the person we're trying to be. And it creates a lot of fear and anger and exhaustion, really, I think. And when you come in on a Friday night and you sit down on the cushion and you work through some of your karma and you enter deep samadhi, it's like somebody has taken rocks off your body. You know, it's like you've been having a big stone holding you down, and you take the stone off and you're just floating in the air. It's so beautiful. And at Sesshin, it's an even deeper experience because, you know, people come to Sesshin with many problems. You know, everybody has problems. But at the heart of all these problems is this, like, this elemental fear of, I think, not being the person we want to be. And then, you know, somewhere halfway through the Sesshin, you know, you just, like, crack open a little bit. And you realize you're not that person. And it's okay, it's not the end of the world. And maybe this is just a little cracking open. Sometimes it's a big opening up, you know? And at the end of Sesshin, people feel so free, so liberated. You know, it's like you can finally breathe, you know, finally breathe in the air. And your relationship with the world is very different because you're not trying to make it be something. You're not trying to be something, and you're not trying to make it into something. It's just the world as it is, and you're just present. And you don't really know who you are, you know, actually. Nobody, you know, if you really are honest with yourself, it's impossible to say who you really are. If you go deep down into yourself, if you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, you know, you drop through the layers of the mind and you see many different things, you know. At the top layer, you're the person who makes plans and has expectations. You know, when I leave here today, I've got to go grade those last five papers, you know, and I can think about it in language and it's coherent. And then underneath that layer of the mind, there's a layer that's like associational, right? It's just pieces of images. And just things, you know, come and go by association. And then under that, there's deeper memories and images. The imagination is down there. And there's like a little image of yourself at every level. You know, there's a little piece of the self-image at every level of that. You know. But eventually you get down to the bottom and you're just in this emptiness. You know, it's just this emptiness. And really, it's quite lovely. The emptiness sounds so, unfortunate, right? There's a poem by a famous American poet, T.S. Eliot, called The Hollow Man. We are the Hollow Man. And it's an indictment, a scathing attack on modern people. And it says their lives are hollow and empty. And this is, for Eliot, this is the worst thing in the world. But if you sit on the cushion long enough and you go down through all these layers of the mind, you just get to this place where it's like there's nothing there, you know. It's just empty blankness. But the astonishing thing is that it's so beautiful to be in that empty blankness, and you feel so alive. It's so beautiful, and you feel so alive. You know? And astonishingly, if you spend a lot of time in that blankness, everything you encounter feels like part of yourself. Feels like part of yourself. So it's not at all the way we imagine. You know, we're desperately trying to be connected to the world in the wrong way, really. You know, in one of the sutras it says that ordinary way of thinking is upside down. In fact, in a lot of sutras you'll see this phrase, upside down views. The Buddha says people have upside down views. And I think that's very simple and true. You know, people are constantly trying to be real and be connected in a way that makes them less and less real and less connected. You know, it's like if I just, you know, I remember when I was about 14, I was in a circle of kids at school, of guys, and I wanted, I thought these guys were very cool. You know, they were very cool guys, and I wanted to be accepted by them. And they knew, like, music. They knew rock music, and they were very hip. And they had special kind of, like, Beatles haircuts, you know. And I desperately wanted, it seems so stupid now, of course, but at the time it was so important to me to be liked by them. And I remember that there was a kind of a shirt that people from England were wearing, the Beatles, it was a kind of Beatles shirt. And it had buttons in an odd way on the shirt. So it didn't go straight, the opening in the shirt wasn't in the center, it was on the side. And I think in one of the big rock groups, they all had shirts like this, right? And so I remember going to the store with my mother and seeing this shirt and just begging her to get me the shirt. And at that time, I don't think she bought me the shirt. I think I got it later somehow. But I remember at the time I felt so cheated. You know, it was like, now I'll never be liked, you know, because you didn't buy me that shirt. You know? And that's so easy to see, but it's so easy to see when you're talking about a 14-year-old. You look back at yourself and realize that was really silly. But we all do that all the time, you know. People do that all the time. And that strategy, it's like if I just do this, people will like me. You know, if I just do this, I'll finally be connected. Actually, the more you sort of create that fantasy person, in my opinion, the more separated you get from things. And when you stop trying to do that, when you can be constantly present or often present with that emptiness in yourself, strangely, you're very full of energy and actually love. And everything around you comes to life. It's very beautiful. And actually, this is sort of what Zhao Zhou is getting at. You know, some monk comes up to him, and a monk asks Zhao Zhou, what is the living meaning of Chan Buddhism? And Zhao Zhou said, you know, the cypress tree in the yard. You know, this is he's manifesting a mind that has worked through its fears and its obstacles over and over. You know, humans produce illusions all the time. Every time something hurts us, we produce like new illusions. It's just true. Every time we feel threatened or in danger, there's a part of us that tells stories, that makes up stories, you know. And every time we feel threatened or in danger, this part of ourselves starts spinning out little stories. It's just like an oyster secretes a shell, you know. We secrete ideas and stories to protect ourselves, you know. So we always want to tell the story in a way that will make us like the hero or the winner. And you know, after presidential debates, you know, those are after presidential debates, you get commentators from both sides that'll say, I think that McCain actually did very well. It looked like he was having trouble, but actually he was doing very well, right? And then the other side will say, yes, but actually Obama did much better than McCain tonight. You know, oh no, I disagree. I think McCain did better than Obama, you know. And we can laugh at that. We can say that's just spin, you know, but actually we spin all the time. It's the truth. We always tell stories that will make us the hero or try. But then, you know, heroes have superhuman powers that we don't really have. And at some point, you know, we can't really like sustain that illusion anymore. And then we get exhausted. and unhappy. Whereas, you know, if you just keep clearing away the karma, and you reach this point that's sort of empty, you can be very open, very free. It's really beautiful. And when people do this together, like at a sesshin, it's very deep kind of intimacy, in my opinion. Very deep. And in fact, you can be intimate with everything around you. So this is sort of what Zhao Zhuo is manifesting, you know, manifesting. And the poem has a message, same kind of message. The poem that I didn't read properly says, "The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current." In other words, you know, if you stop trying to be a special hero self, you begin to experience everything as like yourself. So it's like your eyes are the hills, and your tongue is the river, and so on and so on. It's like you begin to experience everything as part of like your own body. It sounds crazy, but the boundaries of the self are not what we think. You know, everything really is interconnected. It really is one life. Now, it's easy to misunderstand this a little bit. I was reading something in the newspaper this week, and it was by a woman who had started to do Vipassana. It was a very interesting article. I wish I could remember her name, but it was called The Edge. It was an article in the New York Times. It was this woman had said she tried to do some Vipassana, which is a little like Zen. You learn how to just keep bringing your mind back to the moment. And she said something very interesting. She said, you know, when she started doing this, at first she felt very connected, very connected. But then, she said, you know, she would sit down on like a busy bus in New York City, on a bus, and start watching her breath, and she'd feel this deep, she'd get calm, she'd feel connected and everything. And she said, "I really felt at one with everything." But she said, you know, in another sense, I was very detached from everyone around me. I was very detached from everyone around me, even though I felt inside myself very connected, I was really very withdrawn from everyone around me. And she said that you know, her husband had started to complain when she was doing Vipassana, because she would go into a room and sit down on a cushion and sort of like be away from the family for a while. And she said, you know, she had a friend who called her up one day and said, "Yeah, I'm so mad at the Republicans," or something, you know. And the woman who wrote the column the woman who'd been doing Vipassana said, "Well, you know, try to work through your anger." And the person said, "God damn it, I don't want to work through my anger, you know. I want to have," how did she put it? She said, "I want to have a rant." Right? Anyway, the woman who wrote the column said finally, "You know, I don't want to lose the rant." But actually, you know, you're welcome to not lose the rant. You can do both. You know, you can sit on the cushion, and you can get off the cushion, and you can rant. But this woman's article was maybe meant to be kind of a criticism. But, you know, if you want to practice Zen, you have to say no to conventional reality. That's a fact. So there's a kind of reality which is like the group reality. It's the, I would say, collective dream. You know, most people think that the reality that our culture has made for us is real. That this is real. Every once in a while, it becomes very dreamlike, in a nightmare way, And we realize, oh my gosh, it might not be real. So, for example, the stock market has fallen apart. And one of the men who was in charge of the economy said, if only we could believe in the economy again, everything would be all right. Now that's a strange thing to say, isn't it? Because, you know, airplanes will take off whether you believe in them or not, right? So you know, airplanes work whether the passengers believe they will fly or not. They do fly. But here's the head of the American economy, basically, Mr. Summers, saying, just try to believe and everything will be okay. See? Now, at a moment like that, you realize, oh my God, this is a collective dream, isn't it? It is. It's a collective dream. You mean the economy will be okay if we just believe it's okay? Now, if that could be true, but it's not real in the way like a plane, you know, even if every passenger on a plane is convinced it's not going to take off, it'll still take off, right? So there's something totally bizarre about Mr. Summers asking people to have faith in the economy, right? And even Obama said it. He said, you know, don't put your money under a mattress, you know. Now, really, at that moment, when those kinds of things happen, we realize this is a kind of collective fantasy. But make no mistake about it, you know, if you're going to walk the path of Zen, you have to say no to the collective fantasy. You have to be willing to question the group. And you have to be willing to close the door on your husband, yeah, or your wife, or your kids once in a while. That's like the simplest, that's like Zen Buddhism 101. First, say no to the group reality. And then let's see what reality is actually all about. So I don't quite accept this woman's criticism. I think when you sit down and you watch your breath and you feel connected, you really are connected to the tree in the courtyard. But you are, in a way, saying no to something too. You're saying no to the dream machine, right? Movie stars, stock exchange. This, I think, is like collective dream. And my personal feeling is if you cling to that, you will be an unhappy person. And if you don't believe me, just look around. There's a world of unhappy people. Mr. Madoff is going to prison for 150 years. Right? You know, and he was like a leader of the New York financial community. And everybody said, and he can't be a crook, you know. My God, he's a genius. The man is a financial genius, you know. It turns out he never invested a dime. The whole thing was this massive pyramid scheme. They had a psychiatrist on the radio when I was driving to campus the other day, and the interviewer said to the psychiatrist, "How could Madoff have done this?" You know, and she said, "You know, people start with little tiny falsehoods they tell themselves in order to feel good about themselves or in order to feel they have control." So, you know, he didn't make up this whole scheme all at once. He probably told a very small lie. He even convinced himself it was true. You know, and she said at some point people get so lost in a kind of structure of fantasy, you know. And she said, this is very human. And I just thought, you know, you've got it, sister. That's the truth. Yes, in a way, when we sit on the cushion, we are saying no to something. We're saying no to the collective dream. That's not reality. It's okay once in a while to close the door on your husband. Your kids are going to be okay for half an hour, you know. And when you come out, if you're not on the edge of a nervous breakdown, you'll be better, right, with everybody. So even though we might feel guilty sometimes saying, no, I'm going to go meditate, we might think, oh my God, I've got papers to grade, blah, 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 you know, There's always going to be something to do. You could have done something else, but you came here this morning. And that's a very wonderful, I think, wonderful thing to do. And when you go to your job, when you go back to your family, you know, I think you'll be a little calmer, a little more balanced, better able to respond to the situation. Doesn't mean you don't make mistakes, but better, right? Better. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the living meaning of Chan?" And Zhao Zhou said, "The cypress tree in the yard." Just, they're sitting in the yard, in the courtyard of the temple, and there's a big cypress tree. He says, what's the deep secret of Chan? What is enlightenment anyway? And he said, it's being here without our illusions. Okay? The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn. Ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace, is sitting on this cushion. Old Zhao Zhou, stirring up the monasteries, never yet stopping, uselessly expending effort. In other words, he's a great Zen master. Right? Anytime in koans, when somebody's insulted, it's usually a compliment. Still, the card is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, still it fills the ravines and the gullies. So everything fits together if you don't cling to these illusions. Everything fits together. Like a wheel when a wheel rolls along, it makes a little trench, and it's like a wheel in the trench. This is the mind, the unified mind in accord with the way. All self-centered striving ceases, and doubts come to an end. So thank you very much for coming here to sit. Let's do this. My prayer, my whole being would be so happy if we could do this for another 14 years. Okay?